Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each day we bring you a passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength, insight, and wisdom in everyday life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
You don't know what's going on with people. Those of us who are not celebrity gossip addicts missed it. But a few weeks before the tragic and premature death of Chadwick Boseman, pictures showed him to be alarmingly thin and haggard. In comment sections and meme accounts, people joked at the effects of a few months of quarantine. Others called him Crack Panther, implying that drugs were to blame for his radical change in appearance. Of course, we know now why he looked that way. He was dying of stage 4 colon cancer. He had only a few more days to live. Even if you did not see these pictures or jump to those conclusions, the lesson is a sobering one. We have no idea what people are going through. The famous singer who puts on weight, the coworker who is messing up over and over again, the new person you're dating who seems to be suddenly preoccupied, the rude person in traffic, even the Karen who is melting down on video at the grocery store. We have no idea about their private struggles. We have no idea about their pain. Marcus Aurelius tried to remind himself that people and events are not asking to be judged by you. You have the option of having no opinion, he said. So somebody gained weight. So somebody seems different lately. Unless you're providing sympathy or help, why don't you mind your own business? Nobody asked for your criticism. Nobody needs you to make fun of them. They're struggling. They've got more than enough on their plate, and they don't need you adding to it. Remember that, because every time you forget, you risk ending up like the people who got their kicks mocking a guy dying of cancer. You end up missing what was actually quiet and profound heroism. May he rest in peace.
Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. Sometimes you get a surprise email out of the blue and it just makes your day. And the surprise email I got a few months ago came from Arthur Brooks. He was asking me if I wanted to be on his podcast. And he said that he read the Daily Stoic and he liked my stuff. And he wanted to talk about philosophy and modern life. And the reason this made my day is I'm a huge Arthur Brooks fan. I read everything he publishes in The Atlantic. There's even a Daily Stoic email, I think a year or two ago, about his fantastic piece on professional decline. But Arthur Brooks is just, I think, one of the great philosophical and political thinkers of our time. He's a professor of leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Harvard Business School. He was previously the president of the Enterprise Institute, but he's, I think, a great social scientist, a prolific author. He's given hundreds, thousands of speeches all over the world. He mixes science and ancient wisdom, philosophy, music, art. He was even previously a world-class professional classical musician. He played the French horn. We really get into it in this episode. We nerd out about Stoicism, Epicureanism, our obligations to each other as human beings. We talk about virtue. It's a great conversation. I didn't want it to end. I'm really looking forward to you hearing my conversation with the one and only Arthur Brooks. You can check out his stuff. He's at Arthur Brooks on Twitter, and you can just go to arthurbrooks.com. He's got some great books as well that are worth reading. Love Your Enemies, The Conservative Heart, The Road to Freedom, Gross National Happiness, and his first book, Who Really Cares, which is about charitable giving. So a fascinating writer and thinker. And there's also the Arthur Brooks podcast, which you can listen to my episode of and many other illustrious guests. So here is my interview with Arthur Brooks. I loved your piece on professional decline. It was fascinating, but I do feel like in a way you are a walking contradiction of it. I feel like you've been absolutely on fire lately. Your Atlantic pieces have been, you know, sort of hit after hit in sort of deep, thoughtful, provocative pieces in a time of mostly disposable sort of partisan hot takes.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it. And, you know, coming from you, that means a lot because as near as I can tell, you've been on fire since you're about 14 years old. But the key thing about that piece about professional decline is not that you're going to inevitably decline and go away or become unproductive. It means that certain skills decline, but other skills are behind them. And so this is the really important thing to keep in mind. People who get good at something, particularly in knowledge industries, idea industries, they have this thing called fluid intelligence. Now, fluid intelligence is analytic capacity, the ability to figure stuff out, to invent things from nothing. And that ability increases through your 20s and stays high in your 30s and then declines like a rock in your 40s and 50s. And most people see that as their decline. And that's why they panic. They get into their early 50s. It's like, I don't have my groove. And they see what got them to be really good at what they do is no longer in abundance. If they're a lawyer, you know, whatever. But here's the good news, Ryan. There's another curve behind it. The fluid intelligence curve is not treating you bad. I mean, it's leaving you behind, but there's a crystallized intelligence curve, which is one where there's synthetic knowledge, the ability to assemble stories, the ability to figure out what things mean, to teach, basically. And so what I've been able to do in my career, I'm 56 years old, I'm older than you, a lot older than you are. I've been able to convert my career. Early on, I was an analyst. I was writing, you know, math theory. I was an academic economist. And now I'm writing for more popular audiences. I'm harvesting material that other researchers are using. I'm putting it together in stories and titling people how they can use it in their lives. Two curves.
Yeah, I think you see this in sports probably most starkly, where the raw athleticism declines, but the athlete gets smarter, wiser, better at deception, better at strategy, you know, Jared Goff and Tom Brady meet in the Super Bowl. Goff has all the athleticism that Tom Brady doesn't have, or you could look at this with Patrick Mahomes as well, but it doesn't work as well. But what Tom Brady has is the ability to perform under pressure, the understanding of the game, the ability to pace himself. And so I think you see this in athletes as sort of a microcosm of what we all go through, which is you get worse, as you're saying, you get worse at some things, but much, much better at perhaps even more important things.
Yeah. And it sort of depends on the industry, to be sure. Professional athletes all can't just use their brains and continue to go on and on and on. But you and I sure can in idea industries, but we have to know how to get from one curve to the other. And there's this very uncomfortable liminal state when you're declining in one and increasing in the other. And some people just don't want to jump off their fluid intelligence curve. They want to stay at what made them really good, but that's always a mistake. You know, it's worth pointing out, you said something important a minute ago, and it makes sense because, you know, you're the captain of the Stoicism ship in modern times. Nobody ever says that a virtue is intelligence. Everybody says that wisdom is a virtue. And that's really what the first curve is. It's your brain's curve. And your second curve is your wisdom curve. So you can actually go not only from one skill to another. They're not morally equivalent. You can go to a superior a skill morally as you get older.
I think about that as a writer. I've been lucky enough to be successful early. I put out my first book when I was 25. But one of the things that struck me, I think this is starting maybe with Stillness, maybe before, but it struck me one day that this pace was not sustainable. That when I look at the writers that I really admire, they do it not just into their 60s, but you know, sometimes they're writing up until the very day that they die. I mean, there's that famous line from Da Vinci, like the last thing he ever wrote. You know, he's working and then he just goes, "Ah, my soup is getting cold," and then he dies. Yeah. Like he's working up until the last minutes of his life. And if that's what you want, it strikes me that not only do you have to make this transition you're talking about, but also pace and sustainability are important virtues to figure out.
Sure. And it's actually an equivalent or a similar story to the Da Vinci story, which is the story of Johann Sebastian Bach, which is kind of instructive. So early on, he was this incredible innovator in the High Baroque, and people sought him out. And he was doing stuff that nobody else was doing. He was the master inventor. He was an entrepreneur musically. And then about the time he was 50 years old, he got left behind in a big way stylistically because his own son, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, ushered in this newfangled style of music called classical music that was taking Europe by storm. And nobody wanted to hear Baroque music anymore. It was like disco, man. I mean, it was just completely passé. And so he rededicated himself to being an instructor of the High Baroque. He was way less famous and way less rich. He just was hanging out with his family. He was an organist and at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. He was the greatest teacher of his time, known as such. And he was writing a textbook when he died. It was called the Die Kunst der Fuge, the Art of Fugue, which was based on 20 fugues and canons to demonstrate the greatest of the High Baroque, even though nobody cared about it anymore, for future posterity. And he was writing one of his famous contrapuntuses, which is one of the fugues, and it stops literally mid-measure when he's 65 years old, stops mid-measure. And his son, the one who overtook him, writes in the margin of the score, at this moment, the composer put down his pen and died. Strong finish, man. But the point is, you can continue to be productive, but you have to stay in your lane. You have to figure out what your curve is. You have to figure out what you're uniquely suited to. And you have to be able to have to be willing and able to jump to the new curve when it's time.
Yeah. And there's something about writing too. Like I'm a huge fan of Michael Lewis. And what I think about his career is he writes all these, you know, he writes his first book, Liar's Poker, which is his sort of young memoir, does these other books, all very successful. But you could also argue that sort of his development as a writer perfectly intersects with the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, and you get The Big Short. So there's also this, I think, element of, you stay in the profession as long as you can. You work on the skills, and then you're also hoping that you meet your moment, that your skills become perfectly suited for some future moment that you really can't even anticipate yet. And that's where really great, profound work comes from.
It, indeed. Although we have to be careful not to mistake that profound work with worldly rewards and adulation and accolades. So it's perfectly possible that anybody listening to us right now has not, you know, is a fantastic writer and is doing things with great intrinsic creativity and importance and won't get that moment. That window won't open up. And that's got to be okay. I mean, the key thing is, and this is an Aristotelian distinction between telic and atelic activities. And you know all about this too, but not everybody in the audience is going to be, you know, thinking about telos and because this is actually pre-Stoic in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But the atelic or telic activities are those that have telos, that have a goal, have an end in mind. They're instrumental. They're incomplete per se. You do them for something else. In other words, I'm going to write this book because I want it to be a huge bestseller. I don't know about you, but I've never written a book because I want it to be a huge bestseller. I write these books because there's like bursting out of me like the alien out of my chest in the beginning of that movie. It's like I can't not write these books. And the point is that what Aristotle says, if you want a complete activity that will bring you joy, that will bring you fulfillment, that will make your soul complete, you need to do atelic things, things that are useless in and of themselves, that are complete and that bring satisfaction without being instrumental to something else. And so we got to be careful about that. I mean, sure, you and I have written books that people have read and bought. And you, I mean, it's like unbelievable starting when you're 25 years old. But that can't be the reason you do creative work. That's a mistake, because you won't find satisfaction. You'll get on the hedonic treadmill. You'll run, run, run. You'll actually, your wants will outstrip your haves, and you'll become less satisfied, paradoxically, the more you have.
No, that's a great point. I think Michael Lewis is a good example of that as well. He did a book, and I'm forgetting the title, which itself is illustrative, but he published a book about sort of the future of the internet and technology in like the day that the tech bubble burst. Like, he'd been working on this book for years and years, and then it turned out to be exactly what people did not want to read about. So there is this element of luck. And I think what's great about The Big Short is not that it sold extremely well and then got turned into this great movie. I think the point about external, internal rewards, which is that the years of mastery happened to line up perfectly with the right story. And then on top of it, it was also successful. But I think what gets you going maybe through the start of the professional decline, and again, you see this with athletes where, you know, they were the star of a team, and then actually the role of their life was being a backup or a mentor to some future athlete. Like, you don't know what the future holds. There's this great Marcus quote where he says, you know, it's really a shame for the soul to give up before the body. And I think what he's saying, or before the end, I think what he's saying is that even as the body starts to fall apart, you have to have this kind of determination and this commitment, this love of the craft or the profession. And that's what keeps you going. And I think is ultimately the source of your best work.
I agree. There's another thing that happens, however, maybe you're starting to encounter it or maybe not. I mean, you live a pretty simple life down there in Austin, Texas, out on your little ranch with your little bookstore. And I mean, Ryan Holiday has got a lot going on, but in a good, simple way. And this is something that I learned some years ago that I think is probably useful for the audience as well. I was touring this museum, the National Palace Museum in Taiwan, which is the world's largest set of artifacts of Chinese art. It's incredible, from, you know, Paleolithic stuff to the Qing Dynasty at the beginning of the 20th century. And I was actually, I hired a guy because I wanted to know, I didn't, you know, it's another Jade Buddha, right? I wanted him to, and then all, it's so vast, all you remember at the end is like the gift shop or something. So I said, no, I want you to explain the difference between Eastern and Western art to me, because this guy had been trained in both. He's a Chinese guy who'd been trained in both. And so he's showing me this enormous jade, countryside scene, 3-ton boulder from the Ming Dynasty or something. And I said, so what's the difference between this fundament philosophically and Western art? He said, he answered with a question, because that's how, you know, it's a mysterious way to do it. He said, what do you think of when I say a piece of art that has not yet been started? I said, I don't know, an empty canvas. He said, right. We think of a boulder of jade that is yet to be uncarved. And I said, why? He said, because for you, art is something that you make from nothing. From us, art is something that we take away to reveal. And then he said something that was really profound to me. It really changed my life a lot. He said, that's how you think about success in the West too. It's getting more, 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 more. We think of actual success by the end of life as taking away all the parts of your life that aren't you, because you need to reveal yourself. That's success, is to actually understand who you truly are. And the detritus of excess possessions and material things and relationships and experiences, and by the way, and political opinions, which are just chunks of jade to chip away until you can actually find, you know, deep Ryan within, the Buddha within the piece of jade. Boy, that really helped me out a lot, because as I'm moving from my fluid to crystallized intelligence, I'm finding I'm just shedding stuff like crazy. I've gone from slopping paint out of my canvas to chipping away my boulder.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
today.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Well, I think the last year has been illustrative of that. Just how little, the Stoics say this, just how little is actually needed for the happy life. You know, as your life gets radically simpler, the amount of things you're able to do is forcibly reduced. I'm sure there's some people who have become much less happy, but almost everyone that I know that's busy or successful has really reconnected with what they want to do with their life and who they are over the last 12 months. Obviously, this comes from a position of privilege to a certain degree. Of course, if you're having to show up every day to work at a grocery store, there's an additional set of challenges, or if you lost your job or your house or something. So I'm not trying to be flip about it, but I think the massive winnowing, this forced lifestyle experiment we're in, sort of is this idea that actually you don't need all the things that you think you have to work so hard to accumulate.
Yeah, no, the thing about the coronavirus epidemic that I think is instructive, you know, we talked about, you know, the time between the curves, but which is just a transition. And the coronavirus epidemic, no matter where we are in our lives, is a transition. It's a forced transition. It's an involuntary transition. So therefore, it's an unwelcome transition. But transitions per se, there's a lot of research on this, especially when they're unwelcome, they're the most fertile periods in our lives. This is called what psychologists call the liminal state, to be betwixt and between. And when you're in the liminal state, you actually are profoundly uncomfortable. And as such, you can learn more and gain new skills in ways you otherwise wouldn't be able to. So what I'm finding is there are kind of two kinds of people during COVID: those that are resisting the transition, and so therefore are not learning, and those who have stopped resisting the transition, and so therefore they're learning a lot about themselves. And so this is the key thing. Look, we're not done with this thing yet. Everybody has an opportunity to, and none of us is like, yeah, hooray, I hope it lasts forever. No, we all want this thing to be done. And some people have, as you correctly point out, have endured a tremendous amount of hardship and even tragedy. Most people, thankfully, have not. But they're like, ah, can't wait for this thing to be over so I can get back to traveling, so I can get back to waiting in a TSA line and or sitting in traffic. Are you kidding me? What are you learning about yourself? I mean, this is going to be, in retrospect, if you're doing it right, one of the most fertile periods of your psychological and creative development. But you got to let it happen.
Yeah, this is the Stoic idea of amor fati. Do you sort of love it and accept it, or do you spend your time resenting it, trying to make it otherwise, waiting it out? And I think, yeah, especially for creatives, because it really is much closer. The last 12 months have really been much closer to what our lives should be like if we were as disciplined and focused as we probably ought to be.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. It coincided for me. It was real serendipity. I retired from my job as a president of a think tank in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I had been doing 175 speeches a year. I was doing 100, trips per year, because I had to raise $50 million and sort of be out there all the time. And I was always regretting the hit that I was taking to my creative life. It was brutal. And I was like, oh, if only I had time. And so I retired in the middle of 2019, and I came to teach at a university, which is what I do now, so I could write a column and finish my books and do my research and do a podcast. And then the world stopped. The world said, okay, buddy, if you, it's like you asked for it, you're going to get it. I tell you, this has been, there's this one image that I keep getting in my head, Brian, that might be useful. It was this, it's a memory from when I was a kid. I used to go fishing a lot. And I remember the first time I went fishing in off the Oregon coast. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle. And the fishing in the ocean is actually like no other kind of fishing, because you have to know the tides. And I was, first day, I'm on the rocks and I'm casting out, I'm catching nothing. And it's like wizened old mariner comes up to me and says, hey kid, you catch anything? I'm like, no. He says, you getting any bites? Like, no. He says, because you're doing it wrong. So what are you talking about? He says, you can't fish now. You can only fish in a falling tide. Now, falling tide is when the tide is going out really fast. And you'd think that there are no fish because they'd all be going out to sea. He says, no. In a falling tide, the plankton and bait fish are all stirred up. And so the game fish go crazy. Watch this. We wait for 45 minutes, throw in our lines, and we're pulling out one fish after another right next to each other. And for like a half hour, it was great. And then we're sitting on the rocks and he's kind of contemplative. We're sort of relaxing afterwards. Me and this old man, he lights up a cigarette and he says, hey kid, you know, during a falling tide, you can only make one mistake. I said, what's that? He says, not having your line in the water. And I remember that right now because, Brian, we're in a falling tide. The coronavirus epidemic is a falling tide. It feels like everything is going away. But what's really happened is that the bait fish are stirred up. Get your line in the water, because that's when things are really good. That's when magic can happen.
It's beautiful. That's really beautiful. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I've talked about is that as you become successful at whatever it is you do, writing, running a think tank or whatever, you get more and more inquiries to do things that are not quite that thing, or that things are that are related to that thing that take you away from whatever it is that you actually want to be doing. And so you have to have quite a bit of discipline, but also what the mind does is opportunity costs are very hard for us to wrap our heads around. Yeah. So I think one of the things the pandemic really revealed for me is I thought I was being productive before. I thought I was fishing with the tide. You know, I thought I was, but I wasn't aware of what I was not doing. Wow. And so the last 12 months, as I've seen my productivity go up, my happiness go up, my connection with my family go up, it's now very clear to me what obstacles in my old life were preventing that source of connection.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's funny because the worldly rewards, money, power, pleasure, fame, I mean, they come crowding in, and we know in our hearts that there are really only four things: faith or philosophy, which is one, family life, friendship, and meaningful work in which we can earn our success and serve other people. Those are the only, and literally, and this is, I teach this a class in the science of happiness at the Harvard Business School. And I can tell you, those are the only four in your happiness portfolio. Those are the only accounts you need to put something in every single day. It's super Stoic, I know. I mean, it's like, because yeah, they knew everything before we behavioral social scientists even had the data. But the problem is that those things get crowded out. The good four get crowded out by the bad four: money, power, pleasure, and fame. And so the result is, you know, and what I worry about is the coronavirus epidemic finishes and we're like, oh, look at all this opportunity, these speaking engagements. And everybody's got their equivalent of that. And I mean, that, sure, it's like you and I are, you know, two guys who, you know, write books and give talks and do podcasts and such. And most people are not doing that, but they have their own version of that. So the key thing is, what can I learn and what can I retain, notwithstanding the fact that the worldly idols are not singing to me as loudly, right? Because this is the key. These are all idols. I mean, money is an idol, and we need a certain amount of it, but it satiates really quickly. Fame, literally, if you look at the data, is the only of the worldly rewards you can only be happy in spite of. It can't make you happy, but you can only be happy in spite of it, despite the fact that we want it for evolutionary reasons, power, et cetera. I mean, you fill in the blank. So we have to basically be asking ourselves, so that we're living metacognitively, what am I learning right now that I'm going to resist when the idol comes back?
You talked about philosophy, and I know you did this piece recently on sort of some of the differences and similarities between the Epicureans and the Stoics. I do feel like, weirdly, the last year has been, it's drawn on a lot of Stoicism in the sense that one had to endure, one had to manage their perceptions, one had to care about, how one's actions affect other people. One had to have some wisdom to wade through all the insane, contradictory information out there. But there's also been the quieter life that we're talking about. There's an Epicurean flavor to that, which I've enjoyed. I'm wondering though, which of those lives are you drawn towards? Are you the active participant in public life, or are you more of the sort of quiet introvert, do my meaningful work? Are you a mix of both?
Well, I try to be a mix of both, but my natural state is to be out there. I'm at the 99th percentile in extroversion. And furthermore, I have this very, very strong Stoic disposition. I was a classical musician for the first 12 years of my career. So you were publishing
French horn, right?
Yeah, exactly. So when I was the age that you were getting your first bestseller, congratulations, I was actually playing in a symphony orchestra in Barcelona. Because all the way through, I dropped out of college when I was 19. Until I was 31, I made my living as a professional French horn player. And to be a classical musician is an absolutely Stoic lifestyle. I mean, you think of professional musicians as being sort of Epicurean soft, giving into every whim. It's, no. I mean, it is super hardcore. It's like being a professional athlete. You practice your scales when you don't want to practice your scales. You do your duty without any questions, and you do it privately as well as publicly with no loopholes, because that is the integrity that makes the person who the person is supposed to be, which is a very Stoic way of thinking, the idea of moralism and naturalism. Sure. And I'm very, very drawn toward it. I mean, I think that any success I've been able to have as in the intellectual world, publishing books and writing and being a professor now, getting through my PhD in my 30s was because I had played the French horn. It's because I had like this hardcore Stoic boot camp as a classical musician early on. So that's my natural disposition. I married an Epicurean. My wife is from Barcelona, and the Spanish are very Epicurean in their outlook. There's not very much Stoicism. Ironically, Seneca was Spanish. Did you know that?
Right. I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So
he's from Cordoba.
Yeah, exactly right. And so he was Roman, but no, he was Spanish. But anyway, my wife, she's disciplined about all of the right things, disciplined in the soul, but she also understands that one has to enjoy one's life in a way that I just don't. I mean, I will defer my gratification until it's like I have a time horizon that goes to 1,000 years after my death. It's absurd. Right. How much I will actually defer my gratification. My wife's like, no, I'm sleeping in today. That's, it's cold outside the bed. It's nice here, and there's nothing wrong with it. And I'm not doing what I need to do. And I'm like, no, do you understand? You got to get up and lift. It's time to get up and lift.
No, it's funny. I have those same discussions with my wife, and our I think part of being together so much over the last year has helped us sort of realize areas where the different sides of our personality are bumping into each other. I remember she was saying let's say there's 40 days left in the year. She was like, I want to do 30 Peloton rides before the end of the year. I said, oh, that's interesting. Okay. Then 2 days later, she wasn't riding. And I was like, are you going to ride today? And she was like, no, I don't think so. And then the next day, I was like, are you going to ride today? Because we were making a schedule. She said, no, I don't think so. I got this feeling inside me. This is, I couldn't. And then I realized, I was like, if for the first time, I usually we'd have just argued about it or something. And I said, you know, you not writing is giving me anxiety. Like, I'm so organized and disciplined. And I was like, it's not, it has nothing to do with you being in shape or not. It's that you set a goal. You were trying to do a thing and you have 10 days that you're not going to do it. And you've just eaten up 2 days at the beginning. And now that means you only have 8 days. And what could, and so there's a part of me that if I said, I'm going to, you know, I would do it. I would somehow do it. All 40 days, and then also probably some extra days. And so I think it's interesting. I wonder how much of it is philosophical and how much of it is our natural disposition. And the philosophy is there to kind of give you awareness of the assumptions that your mind is, and then realizing like, oh, this is totally insane. Why do I have anxiety about somebody else's made up goal that doesn't matter, that has nothing to do with me? This is basically just OCD in some form. It's a digression, but I think you get my point.
For sure. And Stoics have a tendency to look down on Epicureans. That's just as old as the hills. I mean, you actually look at what Epictetus said about Epicurus. I mean, and you know, he was feminizing the culture of his time, they said. Because, you know, Epicurus, he had this basically a cult. You know, he had these people living in a commune, and they would have peace, and they would have quiet, and they would talk about the importance of finding happiness by remembering pleasant things and all the stuff that, you know, Epictetus would be like, "You kidding me? Are you kidding me?" And so the result is that people who have less fun, because they believe they're holding themselves to higher standards, that is a very dubious proposition. But they also try to hold the people they love to those standards because they believe it's not admirable to not be Stoic. And so that's the key thing to keep in mind. So those of us who are Stoics married to Epicureans, we need to let them guide us a little bit more. There's a key point that those of us who do the science of happiness talk about. You know, happiness is like a meal. Subjective well-being is like a meal. And it's got a bunch of dishes in it and a bunch of ingredients in making it. But it basically has three macronutrients. So just as food is fat, carbohydrates, and protein, the macronutrients of happiness are enjoyment, satisfaction, and meaning. And what Stoics are all about is purpose and meaning. What Epicureans are all about is enjoyment. Now, everybody's trying to get satisfaction, which is incredibly elusive. The way to get satisfaction, of course, as we talked about before, is to manage your wants as opposed to expanding your haves. That's the secret, actually, is that middle macronutrient, that elusive satisfaction. But the key thing is, if you're naturally Epictetus, if you're a Stoic, not Epicurus, then you need to work on your skills in the other department, because a balanced lifestyle is really important. The truth is, if you're all purpose and you're no enjoyment, you'll be like the American Gothic, you know, that Grant Wood painting with that grim farmer with a pitchfork standing next to his grim wife. And if you're all enjoyment and no meaning, you know, let's call that, I don't know, your undergraduate experience or something. It's just not sustainable. You need all the macronutrients. It's actually good that you're married to somebody different than you.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
I wanted to talk to you today about Element. Element is a maker of electrolyte drink mixes that help you stay active at home, work, the gym, or anywhere else. Electrolytes are a key part of a happy, healthy body. All athletes know about the importance of electrolytes, but the truth is we all need them, whether you're an athlete, a diabetic, keto dieter, whether you just want to curb carb cravings, or you want to keep a healthy family. Electrolytes are key for relieving hunger, cramps, headaches, tiredness, and dizziness. Element, that's L-M-N-T, was co-founded by Rob Wolf. Rob Wolf's basically the founder of the paleo diet, a great New York Times bestselling author. He once cooked me some boar at a barbecue in Los Angeles. He developed this electrolyte mix himself. You can try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend and they'll give you your money back. Plus, there's free shipping on all orders. Right now, you can receive a free Element sample pack for just $5. The sample pack includes 8 packets of Element, 2 citrus, 2 raspberry, 2 orange, 2 unflavored. And to claim this, you just go to drinkelement.com/dailystoic. That's drinkelement.com/dailystoic.
Totally. And my wife likes to joke that one of us writes about stoicism and the other one is stoic. Because I think in the Epicureanism, there can actually be a profounder stoicism. And Seneca obviously quotes Epicurus quite regularly. I suspect one of the things that bothers Stoics about Epicureans and why there's this conflict. And there's actually a Stoic named Diotimus, who I write about in Lives of the Stoics, who forges all these fraudulent letters, right, accusing Epicurus of all these crimes, which is partly why his reputation is so extreme to this day. But I suspect that part of it is this sort of insecurity or fear where it's like, you know, so like, let's say you work very hard, you assemble your success and your net worth over your life, and then you meet somebody who, you know, in 3 months makes everything you've ever earned in Bitcoin. You know, there's a part of you that goes, that feels almost attacked, that what you did wasn't necessary. That, like, I think the Stoic fears that the person who's enjoying themselves, that's not holding themselves to such a high standard, it's not that they're getting away with something. It's that you are perhaps doing something, living in a more difficult way than you actually have to be, which is probably true.
For sure. And one of the things that Stoics should understand, they don't always, is that the way you live has to be intrinsically satisfying per se. This is really important to keep in mind. It is that, you know, the discipline is part of the reward. If you're not getting that, then you're going to be stoic in an unhappy way, in a way that doesn't actually give you the satisfaction that you seek, it's not rewarding. And that's a big problem. You're simply denying yourself stuff. Look, the essence of what you write about as an expert in Stoicism, and and if you look deeply at what Marcus Aurelius writes in his Meditations, it's not a chore to be a Stoic. It's a joy to be a Stoic. It's great to live according to your own principles, to live up to your own standards, to effectively pray the serenity prayer every day, to look for a good life well lived, to understand the essence of eudaimonia. That stuff is great. If you're only doing it because, you know, you want to be somehow morally superior, or you're trying to punish yourself, then you're not going to enjoy it. And then some Epicurean is going to come along and will be living the soft life and you'll resent it. But that's a mistake. That's a mistake. Be a Stoic, because being a Stoic is great.
I think that's very well said. Right. If you think that they're going to throw you a parade at the end of your life because you were disciplined and temperate, you're not only going to be rudely surprised. You know, Marcus Aurelius reminds himself of the worthlessness of posthumous fame. Right. I think about this. You take a president like Harry Truman. Almost no one was more unpopular in office than Harry Truman. He makes all these incredibly difficult decisions, tough decisions, but that were almost universally unpopular at the time. The fact that he's vindicated several generations now and is now considered to be a consequential great president, he doesn't get any of the posthumous satisfaction of that. Obviously, you know, depending on your belief of what happens after you die, perhaps you could make some argument. But I think we could say that it's not getting him any pleasure after the fact that he did the right thing. And so my point is not that he should have been a more Epicurean president, that he should have done the easier, more expedient thing. It's that you have to get to a place where you do the right thing because it's the right thing, and you enjoy it because it was the right thing, even if you are criticized and disliked for it. That has to be irrelevant to you.
Totally. I mean, this gets back to Aristotle's concept of atelic experiences, which have to be intrinsically and completely rewarding in and of themselves. And indeed, that's the case. Doing the right thing is incredibly intrinsically rewarding. And, you know, the idea that, you know, Carl Jung had a very interesting theory that the essence of unhappiness is having a set of moral standards and not living up to them. And so basically, you need to, and Jung in this way was very stoic. He said, you need to know what you believe, and then you need publicly and privately with no loopholes to live up to those things that you actually believe. And then you'll actually be happy. And not just like, you know, the ancient idea of, you know, eudaimonia, which is happiness axiomatically, even if you're clinically depressed, you'll actually feel happy too. You'll actually get satisfaction from living that way. And I'm completely sure that's the case. Now, one in defense of Epicureans, which I find really interesting. I mean, it's true. I mean, you were talking about this ancient historian that was trashing, you know, Epicurus all the time, you know, trashing his reputation. There were reasons for that, because these were warring philosophical camps. But Epicurus was not leading orgies. He was not a drunk. On the contrary, hedonism, which comes from hedonia, which was a concept that's profoundly Epicurean, had nothing to do with, you know, living an unbalanced or an out of proportion, you know, life bereft of morals. On the contrary, he believed that it was only when you tamed the appetites could you really enjoy life. And so he would say, for example, he had this, you're really familiar with this, his cure for the fear of death. He had these four rules, right? Don't fear the gods, don't fear death. What's pleasant is easy to get, and what's unpleasant is easy to avoid. Those were his four rules, Epicurus, is for living a happy life. And the part about the fear of death was completely cerebral. You know, his basic formula was just say this. When I'm here, death isn't. And when death is here, I'm not. Case closed. It's done. And then just contemplate that over and over. Now, that's not emotional. That's not feeling. That's complete brain power, and it's muscling it through. And this, I think it's an admirable way. I don't know if it's successful, but it's admirable nonetheless. He was not a hedonist in the modern. He was not Woodstock. If it feels good, do it. Well,
my summation of pleasure for Epicurus is, if it gives you a hangover, it wasn't pleasurable. So it's, you know, does it cause regret, pain? Do you feel disgusting or full or afterwards? Then you probably had too much. To me, Epicurus is really about pleasure in the temperate sense, the sense of moderation. What's just the right amount and no more.
Right. And actually, we would think of it in a slightly different way today. So pleasure is largely based on appetites. When you take your appetites and you add human capital, learning, thought, you know, when you add your own brain power to it, it becomes enjoyment. So, you know, we talk about Epicurus as if he was all about pleasure. He wasn't. He was really all about enjoyment. And enjoyment is a higher art than pleasure. Netflix brings you pleasure. Reading any of your books brings enjoyment, because it actually requires brain power. It requires thought. It requires self-reflection. And that's really important. So, for example, I'm getting tons of enjoyment in an Epicurean sense from our conversation right now. And in point of fact, from my career now, I get tons of Epicurean pleasure, because I just, you know, it's so enjoyable. It's fun, which is pleasurable, but it adds all this intellectual, you know, work to it. So I think that's what Epicurus was getting at.
One place that I definitely agree with the Epicureans, or I think Epicurean logic serves one well, and this is something you wrote about recently, and I really enjoyed it. The idea of, like, finding a place that you love that makes you happy and living there. I feel like there's a, you know, Marcus Aurelius, you can tell he hates his job. He hates Rome. He hates his job. He wishes he could do anything else. And look, there are some of us who are called to certain levels of leadership or certain situations where we'd rather not be there, but we know we have to. And I think there's a time and a season for that. But one gets the sense that Marcus really would have rather done just about anything else, and this burden was foisted upon him. You know, that was a time of a lot less social mobility. It was a broken governmental system as well. But I think I talked to so many people, and it's so obvious to me the root of their unhappiness is that they feel obligated to live in New York City or live in Los Angeles or live in, if not in one of those cities, in a fashion or in a lifestyle that is just at odds with their personality or sustainability or just any form of human happiness.
Yeah, that's the key. So when it comes to where and how you live, it should be an adjunct. It'll never be intrinsically satisfying per se. It'll never be anything more than an adjunct to the happiness that you seek. And that can only come from faith, family, friendship, and work that satisfies you because you serve others and because you earn your success. That's it. When I say faith, I also mean philosophy. Okay. So it can be secular philosophy as well. Transcendental, something that gets you out of your own little boring TV show. Mm-hmm. This is why when people are, they're crazy about the Daily Stoic, right? Because it gets them to a 40,000 foot level when they're, you know, they're not 5 feet off the ground looking at their boring life, a 40,000 foot level. And this is when you read the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, it's like, wow, I'm part of this big adventure out there. And so The problem is that people will live in a place that's not an adjunct to faith, family, friends, and work. It'll be an adjunct to money, power, pleasure, and fame. In other words, it'll be serving the wrong four masters, the idols that are making us walk 180 degrees ultimately away from our happiness. Why do people live in New York? Some people really love it. Some people think it's really awesome and it's great and more power to them. But I know that too. All these people who live in New York or LA and they're, you know, barely able to make their mortgage and they're stuck in traffic all the time. And you'll ask, how come? Well, it's because of one of those idols. What's the main idol in New York? What does everybody talk about in New York? Money. What does everybody talk about in LA? Fame. What does everybody talk about in DC? Power. What does everybody talk about in Las Vegas? Pleasure. Those are the four idols. And so people who are living, there are good reasons to live in those cities. Listen, and we're going to get, you know, like hate mail because people said, why'd you trash my beautiful city?
Sure.
But a lot of people live in those cities, frankly, for the wrong reasons. And they should be maybe in a suburb of Austin, Texas, or, you know, where I live in a suburb of Boston, Massachusetts.
I think what I found, you know, living in outside Austin and first moving to Austin in the first place is you're also surrounded by people who are not motivated by those things. And so I think, you know, was it Joseph Epstein said something like, and of all the seven deadly sins, envy is the only one that's not any fun.
I know. He did say that. That's a wonderful little book called Envy that he wrote.
Yes, actually. It's amazing. But the less you're like, I think envy, obviously, look, sobriety, let's say, take something like sobriety. You got to work on your own sobriety and that's your job. At the same time, you don't want to be around a lot of other drunks or a lot of temptations that make you want to drink or do drugs. And I find envy is one of those things where, yes, you have to work on it, but also the more you can create or design a life that doesn't subject you to the stimulus or the shock of things to be envious of or people to compare yourself to, the easier it is to focus and the easier it is to do what you're doing. Mark Maron's talked about this on his podcast, where the last year, the fact that nobody is doing anything has right. allowed a lot of us to get more in touch with what we want to do because we're not using what other people are doing as our rubric for what we should be doing.
Yeah, I agree completely. Now, envy is an adjunct to pride. And we use pride in a way that makes it sound like a virtue. Like, I tell my kids, you know, my kids are all grown up and, you know, they're doing phenomenal things. One's in the military and, you know, one's a high school math teacher and, you know, one's going off to college. I'm proud of you. I'm so proud of you. That's right. That's not the original intent. It's a deadly sure. sin. Pride is the idea is an excessive love of one's own excellence compared to others. I mean, it's just like there's nothing.
You need pride like as an ego.
Yeah. And envy comes out of that. So envy is something where it's completely about social comparison, which Teddy Roosevelt called the thief of joy. Now, the key thing to understand about all this, and this gets back to a lot of the stuff that you write about the Stoics, pride and envy are fear-based emotions. They're fear-based, and they're not love-based at all. And the problem is that fear and love are opposites. Hatred and love are not opposites. Fear is the ultimate negative emotion. And so if you want less fear, you need to surround yourself with more love. You need to surround yourself with more family and with more friendship. You need to surround yourself with ideas that really light you up, a love for God. You need to love more. And that's the ultimate way that we can cure this. But if you're in a fear-based polarity in your life, you're simply not going to be able to attain any of these things that we're talking about, which really is the only secret to happiness.
I'd connect that to another thing you wrote, which I've written about too. I find not only am I happier not living in a major city, but I feel like I'm happier. I'm more connected with my fellow human beings. I'm more charitable. I'm more understanding and empathetic. The less political news that I consume.
Oh, yeah.
So the more I read history, the more I read fiction, the more I talk to actual human beings, the more connected I am, the more I want to participate in the world, the more understanding I am. And then the second I turn on CNN or Fox or MSNBC, or the second I just see what people are saying on Twitter, the more the exact opposite of all those emotions kick in.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, the problem with politics is that it's become this sort of national entertainment mechanism where people get really, really into it. you know, it's the same sort of thing that people who are, it's like you go to England and in pubs, they make it so you can't talk about soccer. Because, you know, if it's a pub on the cusp between two teams, people will literally come to blows over it. And you know, we treat entertainment or politics like entertainment or sport in a big way. And it's also supplanted a lot of religious differences that we have. So as the country becomes a lot more secular, if you go back to 1960, 3% of people your age would say they have no religious affiliation. And now it's closer to 40% of people your age have no religious affiliation, depending on the data you want to look at. And so there's a place that has to be held for, you know, what is the ideology? What is the container for all this stuff that I believe morally? And national politics has filled that, and it's utterly inadequate. It's not up to the task. Religion's good for that. Philosophy is good for that. Politics is terrible for that. So we get this conceit of tiny differences, like, oh, you know, you want a flat tax? I want a fair tax. We can't talk. What do you? Right. That's insanity. And so when you're living, you know, out in Austin, Texas, and you're talking to people who are not very political, it doesn't even come up. I find it so refreshing. Because I ran a think tank in D.C. for 11 years. You know, I was at the vortex of these debates. And when I talk to people who literally, they're like, I don't know, I don't care, I don't know anything about politics. It's so refreshing to me because that's an attitude not of being, you know, checked out in life. That's not somebody who needs to do something. That's somebody who's usually or frequently modeling a set of characteristics that I kind of admire. And I've done a lot of, you know, research on this. It's abundantly clear that the more you think about politics, the more your happiness is going to decline. It's just an inverse correlation between attention to politics and your life satisfaction.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Yeah, I was. I've talked about John M. Barry's book, The Great Influenza, which is an incredible book that I think everyone should have read at the beginning of this pandemic. But what struck me as I'm reading this book is, you're reading about a pandemic that comes from nowhere, overruns hospitals, overruns medical understanding. It mirrors what we're experiencing right now in so many ways. But when you're reading it, you're not like, what were the Democrats doing? What were the Republicans doing? It doesn't matter to you what party Woodrow Wilson is. We have the ability to look at history as human beings doing human things. Sometimes they're good people, sometimes they're bad people. Oftentimes you find the really good people also had really bad sides, and the really bad people occasionally did really good things. And so I think if people say they don't have time to read books, they're going, when am I going to make my way through Thucydides? And it's like, well, what if you just stopped watching Rachel Maddow and you sat down with a book published 2,000 years ago? You know, you say you don't have time to read, but but then actually look at your habits, you're doing lots of reading. You're just reading the wrong things. You're reading, you know, breaking news alerts.
Yeah, you're basically eating potato chips when you should be eating your vegetables. And so you're filling up. And it's equivalent, by the way, of social media instead of having real in-person friendships. It's not nutritious. So you can be both morbidly obese and malnourished simultaneously with junk food. The junk food of social life is social media, and in intellectual life is exactly what you're talking about right now. You had a very nice post on this day before yesterday, I think, where you talked about the importance of stretching yourself with things that are a little too hard for you to read. And then you gave this example of actually instructions. This stuff is so useful because you say, how do you do that? You know, how do you read the Peloponnesian War? I mean, who's going to read the Peloponnesian War? Like, you can. Any of us can. You know, Being in Nothingness by Jean-Paul Sartre. It's like a billion pages long and it's hard. Can you read it? Yes. Yes, you can. You simply need to make a commitment to not doing something else that's more trivial and less useful to you. And, you know, that sort of commitment per se, by the way, that's a very stoic thing to do. It's an incredibly stoic thing to do, right?
Of course. No. And I think the funny thing is, the more history you understand, the more psychology you understand, the more philosophy you understand, the more you understand about human nature, the easier it actually is to get to the bottom of whatever the current issue of the day is without having to read a lot of stuff, because you know, you've seen this before, or you have some sense of you're a better judge of character. You see when you're being bullshitted or not. I tend to find that I can pretty quickly get to what I think about this issue or that issue in the current day based on not the 50 articles that I read about it right now, but my understanding of the human experience generally.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that I do, one of the great things about being a social scientist, is that relying on research about humans is something you can learn an awful lot about. And I teach this class at Harvard that introduces people to the science of human flourishing and relates it to leadership and all the things that we're doing. And they ordinarily they come into my graduate students. These are MBA students at Harvard. They're really smart and motivated, but they've not read very much academic literature of this, you know, the social science literature, the social psych, the behavioral economics, this stuff, because they're intimidated by it. You know, we academics, what do? It's like we putting a gun on the table. Start the conversation by putting your gun on the table. It's like, who's going to argue with you under the circumstances? What I try to do in my class is I make them read 25 to 30 academic journal articles and help them understand that understanding how the hypothesis testing, how the coefficients and the regression analysis, how they're related, all this technical stuff is way less important than the arguments, whether they line up, whether, you know, the sample sizes are legitimate. You get a feel for actually what these things say. And, you know, everybody listening to us, they can actually read research. And you know, I do that every day. I read a couple or three, you know, research papers every day for my job. And I'm just learning all the time. And it's so fulfilling. And it's not just because I'm some nerd with a PhD. I happen to learn some of those statistical techniques, but everybody can do it. So it's not, you can even do something that's more modern than the Peloponnesian War. You can read the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology and learn a whole bunch of stuff about the humans.
When what I recommend too is print the paper out and go to the table in your living room and sit down and read it with a pen or a pencil. Read it, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, you wouldn't have even been able to search for this in a database. You would have gotten it when it was printed out and mailed to you as a journal. And so for hundreds of years, that's how humans have interacted with these complicated, distilled, you know, bits of data or insight that you're just going to browse this as a PDF is not, to me, a great environment to engage in a big idea.
Truly. And that's, you know, the idea of just harvesting information is not the same thing as absorbing the information such that you can use it. It won't help your repertoire of ideas and the synthesis of the concepts that you're trying to put across. But the bottom line is what we're saying here is that we can greatly enhance our lives by doing something that's kind of this you know, weighted sum of Stoicism and Epicureanism. To get greater enjoyment, to add to the pleasure of knowing things. And when I say pleasure, I mean that, you know, one of the primary positive emotions that's processed by the limbic system of the brain, believe it or not, is interest. You know, finding things interesting is inherently uniquely a pleasurable experience. But then adding knowledge to that is actually raised at the level of enjoyment and hence an Epicurean virtue. And then doing something that stretches us, because stretching us is inherently a good thing to do. It's an intrinsically, it's a good thing to do. It's not just morally, it makes us more interesting. And that just makes us a better factory for the Epicurean enjoyment that we're trying to get. So basically, Epictetus can make Epicurus more effective in this way.
I love that. So I have one last question for you. This is less sort of science of happiness and philosophy and more some of your earlier work on sort of free enterprise. I think the last year has been so interesting in that it is illustrated to us what government is supposed to do, what it does well, what it does not do well, what the flaws or weak spots of the free market are. How do you look at the last of the last 12 months, some of the successes, some of the failures, as far as the interplay between the private market and then the state?
There's nothing surprising that's come out, but it reminds us of a lot of truths. The first fundamental truth, by the way, is that we all have to recognize that the free enterprise system has pulled more billions of people out of poverty than any other system in the history of any system in the world ever. You know, that's actually a quote from, more or less a quote from Barack Obama, not some right-wing philosopher.
Sure.
But at the same time, the markets aren't perfect. And the thing that markets aren't perfect at doing is making us moral individuals. And so the first thing that I think the last year has taught us is that morals have to come before markets. You don't even understand what markets are all about. And, Adam Smith said that. He wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, but in 1759, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. He
was his mentor was a translator of Epictetus.
Exactly right. So, morals must come before markets. Your heart actually has to come before anything else. You have to get your ideas, your ethics in order. That's much more important than anything that we're trying to do economically, because your economics will simply magnify your morals. And if your morals are bad, your economics are going to make it worse, especially when you have the accelerant of the free enterprise system of capitalism. Although, that said, I've seen just as much vice and selfishness under socialism as any other system. People are people, is the bottom line. So that's the first thing, morals before markets. The second thing is we have to remember that one of the greatest accomplishments of capitalism, maybe the greatest accomplishment of capitalism, is the social safety net. The fact is that we're able, for the first time in human history, because of the largesse that capitalism brings to our society, to help take care of our brothers and sisters that we've never even seen or met. It's unbelievable. If it weren't for capitalism, there'd be no welfare state. And if it weren't for the welfare state, a lot of people would be literally starving to death right now. And what this tells us is that it's just not appropriate to trash the welfare state or to trash capitalism. We have to find the lanes, the roles that the government and the free market are supposed to play. And what I really want, the country I want to live in, is one where iron sharpens iron, where you have people on the left who are saying, no, more welfare state, and people on the right saying, no, more market. And I want people to duke that out. I want that rumble so that we can see the dynamics of how that goes back and forth, as opposed to right now, not right now, certainly before the coronavirus epidemic, where the politics were basically my way or the highway. You give me everything that I want, or I've unilaterally lost, which is wrong. And by the way, that violates a great Stoic virtue too, which is humility, epistemic humility, that I might not know everything. I might not be right. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I'm not right, at least in everything.
Well, no, I had Charles Koch on the podcast. I don't think it's run yet, but we were sort of talking about this the idea to me, the vaccine, as we're seeing it roll out now, and some European nations fail at it, and even some of the Asian nations, which did a wonderful job locking down, sort of better than the West, or preventing the spread of the virus to begin with, the hybrid of public governance and private enterprise coming together to accomplish an extraordinarily difficult thing, to me is one of the few things that gives me some hope about the future.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's actually, to speak more to your point, even more directly to that, it is true that some of the Asian nations were better at the lockdowns because they're much better with big government and social control than we are. We're chaotic. Right. We don't take directions very well in the United States, especially you guys in Texas. Like, are you kidding me? You tell me what to do, I'm going to do the other thing, basically. Right. And that's part of the spirit of the pioneer, of the immigrant, of the ambitious riffraff. You know, the Holiday family didn't come over here as landed gentry. I mean, they're probably scratching out potatoes in Ireland and, you know, barely making it at some, or something along those lines.
I would argue, though, I think it's true. There's the pioneer spirit. It's also that same sort of, you don't get to tell me what to do spirit. Yeah. That's responsible for some of the grave injustices in our country.
Who is
the government to tell me I can't own another human being and whip them?
Well, I mean, look, there's good and bad from all of these characteristics. Yeah. As you'd expect, you'd be shocked if there weren't. And anybody who's saying that, you know, one policy or one ideology is all good or all bad is trying to sell you a Buick. You know, it's like, you don't believe it. Nothing wrong with Buicks, but there's something wrong with that argument. But okay, so these Asian nations that have a, you know, much larger degree of social control are good at lockdowns. Who's good at vaccines?
Right.
We are. I mean, why? Because we have a tremendously entrepreneurial economy. We have a set of incentives, even beyond the money, to do new stuff, to try incredible things, to be unbelievably creative. And so this is a kind of an interesting juxtaposition of worldviews. You know, we can lock down forever and never find a cure. And it's only because of this interplay that we have in our society between, you know, the cultural characteristics of the United States and the free enterprise system is instantiated in our economy that's going to make it possible for us ultimately to get out of this mess.
That's true. Although I think what's so fascinating, and I think you talked about humility, the world did, but primarily, you know, driven by U.S. companies, invents this incredible vaccine, this miracle, this unprecedented breakthrough in science, which is going to ripple through, you know, generations to come. And then the actual putting of shots in people's arms, which is not quite social control, but it is governmental competence. It's boots on the ground logistics. We've failed that. And you could argue what was great about America in the Second World War is that we had both. We had the economy that drove it, but we also had the organizational competence and the logistics that allowed us to be the arsenal as well.
Well, and also, Ryan, the public spiritedness. You know, it's interesting that you were able to mobilize the war effort, and at the same or more or less the same era, it took 18 months to build the Empire State Building and, you know, a year and a half to build the Pentagon. And it takes 26 years to put down one extra runway at Atlanta Airport because of NIMBY problems. We haven't even built
a memorial to Eisenhower yet. We just opened the Eisenhower Memorial. Yes.
We can't get the shots into the arms here in Massachusetts of people who are really old and at greatest risk because the teachers union has muscled their way into the queue because they have pure unmitigated political power. I mean, God love them, but still that's the problem.
Sure.
It seems to me is we're not all in it together.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And I think your point that this is, I'm not sure you can't mandate public-mindedness. Ultimately, this has to come from faith or philosophy. This has to come from your own sense of virtue and obligation.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's up to us to bring, to improve ourselves and to raise the next generation of people, to hold each other. And primarily, I mean, the Stoic idea is holding yourself to account. That's the most important idea, as opposed to holding other people to account. It's interesting. It's also the way that we argue with each other. You know, this great virtue, I'm on a college campus, and people think the great virtue is standing up to people with whom you disagree. That's not morally virtuous at all. It might be necessary, but real moral virtue is standing up to the people with whom you agree on behalf of those with whom you disagree. That's a hard thing to do because you actually lose friends by doing something like that. And that's, you know, and again, we're in a period right now, I think, between waves of enlightenment, between waves of moral enlightenment. And I think we're due for it. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of people are so attracted to the Daily Stoic and just the stoicism that you're propagating in general, because they want something that's truly good. They want something that's better. They want to hold themselves to account. That's a huge opportunity for traditional religion and for virtuous philosophy to try to make a more public-spirited and more internally coherent, virtuous, and ethical set of individuals.
Yeah, and I know I told you I'd let you go, but there's this great Cicero quote where I think it's Flaubert. He says, you know, between Cicero and Marcus Aurelius, before when the gods had ceased to be and Christ had yet to come, man stood alone in the universe. Now, he's wrong in almost every part of that timeline, like none of it lines up. But the idea of the old systems falling away and not being replaced by something,
right.
I think that's where we are now. Patriotism seems silly to people. As you said, almost a majority of people are not religious. School is almost those things, right? School isn't building up some sense of civic mindedness. It's pointing out all the silly people who were civically minded before you and right. all the mistakes that they made. And so it really leaves people with either a choice between like sort of defaulting to nihilism or having to go find something new or old. And I do hope philosophy can be one of the things that fills that hole.
For sure. I completely agree. And once again, the coronavirus epidemic is pointing a lot of this stuff out where me first, me first, me about the vaccine. Are you kidding me? Let's get us old people and people who have, come on, man. I mean, the philosophical traditions of the 20th century did a whole lot of harm. And the most anti-stoic of them all, of course, was existentialism, which said existence precedes essence. In other words, you're just born. You know, you're just born, and then you just got to create some reason for why. You create it, and you have to figure it. It's like Stoics would be like, essence precedes existence, and my job is to figure out that essence and live according to it. And for my money, that's the way to live. That's where the joy comes in. That's where the happiness comes in. That's where the belonging comes in, and that's where we can serve each other best as sisters and brothers, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah, General Mattis says, cynicism is cowardice. And I think there's a cynicism that I contrast with earnest belief in something other than yourself.
Yeah, I agree with that. I absolutely agree with that. And that's what we can bring. That's what people are going to get by reading your books and listening to your podcasts. And I hope the work that I'm doing as well. Let's start.
I hope they're reading your Atlantic pieces. I love them. And I'm a huge fan. I'm so glad we had this conversation. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm a huge fan, too. Let's stay at it. Let's create the next great enlightenment.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Daily Stoic. It's mind-blowing to me now that we are well over 30 million downloads of this show. It means so much to me to have all of you listen. If you want to help spread the word about the show, please leave a review on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcasting platform is. It helps a lot. And then, of course, click subscribe. That's how we know how many people are listening, and that makes sure you get the episodes as they come in. So thanks again for listening to The Daily Stoic Podcast. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.